Hi, my name is Joan Schweikart, and my favorite thing is serendipity.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. It is Sunday, November 7th. I was so excited to come on this week. Oh, I'm your host, Leah Jones. I was really excited. I thought I was going to come on today and tell you I got my booster shot because I thought I was scheduled to have it at 3 p.m. today. And then I double checked my email and it's not until next weekend. So that was a surprise. And I might just try and go in this week and do a walk-in somewhere because I really need to get it settled before chemotherapy starts on Friday. This weekend, one of my dear soul sisters came to Chicago for the weekend to help me organize my life ahead of chemotherapy. If you're new to the podcast, I was diagnosed with stage one breast cancer this summer. I have had a lumpectomy, many biopsies, breast reduction, which is technically oncoplasty because it's plastic surgery connected to cancer, and I am now healed enough from that to start chemotherapy. So I start on 12 weeks of Taxol on Friday the 12th. And so a friend came up this weekend and we bought like a new cozy chair, new cozy sweatpants, pillows. I made my chemo bag. My friend William Pacholsky at the Portland, he did my episode about Great Comet. He sent me this really funny tote bag that says chemo shit. So we made my chemo shit bag and my chemo shit backup box of medicines, over-the-counter medicines, prescription medicines, throat lozenges, queasy pops, just all these wonderful things that my friends have sent me. This week my coworker sent me a box called Rock the Treatment, which is this amazing organization I'd never heard of before that sent this very cool box of like Tetris level packed with, skincare, queasy pops, cozy socks, coloring books, colored pencils, just all these wonderful items. So I'm really, again, grateful to friends, who are and family who are taking care of me and making sure that this all goes well. And I don't know, the sun is going down. It's 4:30 in the afternoon, daylight savings time either started or ended this morning. Spring forward, fall back. I don't understand how it goes. I still don't. I've lived in states that change their time since I've been 18 and I don't understand it. This week, we're talking with author Joan Schweinhart. She is an author of the River series, and the third book in the trilogy is out. And we are talking about a lot of things. We talk, but mainly about serendipity, the concept of serendipity, where it has played in our lives. It's a really lovely conversation. I hope that you pick up a copy of her books. Learn about this. It's this amazing historical novel set at the peak of the rubber trade. So enjoy this conversation with Joan Schweinhart. Get your booster, get your get vaccinated, wash your hands, wear your mask, and keep enjoying your favorite things. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and get recommendations without using an algorithm. This fall, this winter, we continue to talk to authors who are having book launches. We've talked to memoirists, we've talked to novelists, and today we are talking, I'm really excited to be on Zoom today with Joan Schweigart. Joan is based in New Mexico. She has published, I believe, 9 books, but novels, memoirs, children's books, She's here today to celebrate her trilogy, the Rivers trilogy, which we're going to talk about a little bit. But Joan, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much. It's great to be here with you.
It's great to be here with you. Now, you are in the beautiful state of New Mexico, right?
Yes, I am. Albuquerque.
In Albuquerque. Is it Hatch Green chili season yet?
It's actually Balloon Fiesta season, or a week. It's only a week long. So balloons have been flying over the house all week.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I for 3 years lived in Durango, Colorado.
Oh, okay.
So that was my time in the Southwest, and the Target was in New Mexico. So was in Farmington. And the airport was in Albuquerque. Like, you know, in the Southwest, driving 4 hours to get to the airport is really nothing.
That's right.
And going over a state to go shopping is also just so normal. Your sense of space and time in the Southwest is really different than it is in the Midwest where I live now.
Where are you now?
I'm in Chicago.
Oh, in Chicago. Okay.
Yeah. Very, very different than from Durango.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you grow up in New Mexico?
No, I actually grew up in New Jersey.
Okay.
Which people usually discover once I start talking. Mm-hmm. Somehow it's something I couldn't shake entirely. But yeah. I grew up in New Jersey. I lived on the East Coast all my life. I lived in Florida, in Fort Lauderdale for a while. And then most recently, before New Mexico, I lived upstate New York. And then I came out here to visit somebody and fell in love with the area and stayed.
Yeah, I really, Albuquerque and New Mexico is just such a beautiful state. It's really hard when you grow up, I think, in the Midwest or East Coast, it's really hard to imagine like the vastness of the space even. Hi, cowboy.
I thought you were having an earthquake.
Nope. It's just one of maybe three cats you might meet today.
Well, I have a dog someplace around here. I think he's not in the room at the time.
But I really think it's hard to imagine the color palette of the Southwest is hard to imagine when you're growing up in the Midwest or on the East Coast, and it's just such a stunning landscape.
Yeah, it takes a while to get used to the lack of greenery as much as we had upstate where I lived. It was a kind of rural area. It was only about 80 miles out of New York City, but it was still rural. Mm-hmm. And every year we had so much rain all the time, and every year the trees were coming closer and closer. They really were. Mm-hmm. And it seemed suffocating at some point. So it was great to get out here, but then I really missed how green everything was. Now I'm used to the yellows and the browns, and I really love them. And when the light hits them at a certain angle, my husband is a photographer, so he talks a lot about the light here. And the light is really unique and wonderful.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite foods that you've discovered since moving to New Mexico?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not able to eat as much cheese as I would like, or otherwise I would be eating, tacos and burritos every day.
Yeah,
but I love Hatch chili, which you mentioned earlier. Other than that, you know, just basic Mexican and New Mexican foods.
Yeah.
But I, as I said, I don't get to eat as much of it as I would like.
Yeah, I remember when I moved to Durango, the first time I was at a restaurant and I ordered chili and they asked me if I wanted red or green chili. And I was just like, chili's only red. Like, what? What's happening? And I got a bowl of green chili, just not having any frame of reference. And it was so good. And it's just not something you can get up here. And that's something I miss.
Yeah, I'll have to send you a jar. Well, I always ask for Christmas, which is red and green combined.
Ooh.
Yeah. So, but I've been in restaurants when I first moved here where they would say, do you want Christmas? And it's like, I always want Christmas.
Right. Who doesn't? Oh, I
do
never
have a gift.
Yeah. The gift of delicious soup.
Mm-hmm.
So Joan, you mentioned that we were talking about COVID hobbies. And I was telling you how this podcast came to be. And you said that you've been editing an anthology. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, or do you want to not jinx it?
No, sure. I can talk about it. So my co-editor, her name is Faye Rappaport-Dupre, and I realized that we both knew a lot of other writers. So just, you know, traveling through the book world for many years, I'm a freelance writer, so I know writers through freelance, and I've worked for publishers, and I've also met a lot of writers just through writing my own books and projects. And Faye has the same journey, but in a different area. So we started talking about putting together a book on touch, because during COVID, that was the one thing. It actually started before COVID. My sister died 3 years ago, and my sister was schizophrenic, and she would not endure anybody touching her. So I grew up never hugging my sister, and I sat by her bedside when she was dying, and I did not touch her, even though she was in a coma at the end, in hospice. I still didn't touch her because we didn't have that kind of relationship, and I couldn't. And I had a friend, it was actually a client, whose sister was also dying, and her sister was a hairstylist, and she was a hairstylist, and she had degrees in dental hygiene and a lot of things that are hands-on. And so they had this very different relationship, where Linda would go over and give her sister, while she was dying, a pedicure and a manicure, and do her hair and hug her.
Yeah.
So I just was very interested in the subject of touch. And then COVID happened, and everybody was interested in the subject.
Yeah.
So we invited all of the really great writers and poets that we know to contribute. And everybody liked the subject matter. So not everybody, but mostly everybody that we invited contributed. And we wound up with a lot of really wonderful poems and essays and stories about touch. We have one story from a deep tissue massage therapist. So we have that kind of touch. We have people talking about how touching is more about, you know, you can touch somebody through music, and you can touch them. We have people who talked about touching animals, horses, dogs, and getting what they needed during isolation from that. So all different variations.
Yeah.
We have a mom who's, son has very severe OCD and cannot be touched even by his parents. If you touch him on his left side, you have to touch him on his right side with an equal weight, equal intensity.
Yeah.
So all kinds of really wonderful things.
Well, I hope that a publisher sees the need for a book like that. I think the art coming out of this stretch of time is going to be really fascinating. The things that we need to talk about, that we need to write about, that the absence of, the overpresence of, I think it's just going to be fascinating.
Right. And looking back and seeing how we've changed as a result of all of this. Yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of people have stories about their parents or grandparents and people in their family who grew up in the Great Depression. And, you know, my grandpa kept a room of canned goods just out of that fear of being a young person during the Great Depression, and kept the cans so long that they started exploding.
Oh, no.
He had turned my dad's childhood bedroom into a pantry. And was not looking at expiration dates.
Wow.
Until the pressure required him to look at them. Either that, or it was when they were moving to Florida, and there might have been a conversation about, like, we're not moving the canned goods to Florida. I don't know. I'll have to ask my parents about, like, how that went. But I think we all have those family stories of our family members who grew up in global times of trauma and how it impacted them. And like, we don't know in 20 years, what are the behaviors we're going to take with us?
Right. Especially for children who had all that time off from school.
Yeah.
And socialization. So.
You have been out talking to people about your trilogy. So it's the Rivers trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes place during the rubber boom, is that correct, in South America?
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about this trilogy and first of all, I have to say I'm obsessed with the covers, and I want the covers as wallpaper in every room of my house. I love the covers.
Oh, I'm so happy that you like that, yeah.
So yeah. Where did this trilogy come from? Was it originally going to be one book and you realize there's too much story here, I've got to break it up? Or was your goal a trilogy?
No, my goal was, all right, so actually the thing I'm going to tell you about my favorite thing, I kind of have to identify it as being responsible for the trilogy in the first place. So should I just go ahead and tell you now?
Go ahead and tell me now, and then we'll into it after we talk about the books.
All right. My favorite thing is serendipity.
Mm.
I love when things kind of, I love when there's the feeling, and a lot of people might argue that it's not really anything concrete, but there's the feeling that you've been pushed onto a certain path.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of between novels. I'd written a novel that I really enjoyed. You know, there's all different levels of engagement when I'm sure with any artwork, you know, so you might paint the painting that's you're enjoying, but you're not really in love with it. But I had finished a novel that I really enjoyed working on. And I was waiting for something to inspire me about mm-hmm. what I was going to read next. And a local publisher asked me to do some freelance work for their publishing company. She wanted me to take some of their backlist books that had been published a while ago and, you know, read through them and read reviews and notes about them, and then put together just a paragraph for each book that they could use on their website.
Mm-hmm.
One of the books was an actual diary written by a rubber tapper in 1908.
Oh.
In South America in the jungle. And a relative of his took the diary as it was and annotated it and added some pictures and you know, edits and whatnot, and put it together, and this company published it. So that was one of the books I was asked to read. It's very short. It must have been 80 pages, 75 pages. It awoke in me a love of the jungle. The jungle is a very dangerous place, and it's mm-hmm. also an incredibly beautiful place. And I just loved the book. I couldn't stop reading it.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I fell in love with this book about a rubber tapper, a diary of a rubber tapper. And that might be the only diary in existence of a rubber tapper, as far as I know.
Right. There might be some letters home, but I imagine they are brief.
Right. And a lot of people didn't survive. I mean, it was a really dangerous thing to be doing. And then, so it was in my head, at the, you know, just this thing about rubber tapping. And I started thinking, gee, it would be interesting to write my own book about rubber tapping and have my own characters go off to South America and do this incredible thing. And at the same time, around the same time period, I was watching a PBS special wherein a journalist went to South America to talk to tribal people there, you know, previously uncontacted, yeah. but recently contacted people about what can Northerners do? What can people do to help to stop the drilling that was going on and leaving byproduct behind that was killing the fish and the animals in the places where these people lived and really harming the people and just ruining their way of life completely?
Yeah.
And the person, you know, he was talking through interpreters, the person he was talking to, I think he was a shaman, said, "We can change the dream. we can change the dream. Mm. And I thought, what does that mean? What does it mean to change the dream? That seemed so profound to me. So I Googled it, and it took me to a website called Pachamama Alliance, which is an organization that takes people into the deep jungle to meet with indigenous people and learn about their lifestyles in return for Pachamama Alliance providing legal services so these people can fight off the oil companies that are destroying their lands. So I signed up, and I went into the jungle. It was life-changing. And we traveled all over the Andes, but at the end of the trip, the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 days, we took two small planes. There were only, I think, 8 of us all together. Mm-hmm. And the planes were so tiny that you could only take a few people at a time. And we flew into the deep jungle, and we landed on a dirt airstrip in the middle of the jungle. And then the indigenous people who we were going to stay with came down the river, and we got onto the boat with them, and we spent days with them. We participated in some ceremonies with them. It was just life-changing. Mm. So I'm getting verklempt talking about it.
Wow.
But then when I came home, I was like, okay, I'm writing a novel that takes place in the South American jungle and has something to do with rubber tappers. And then I just went crazy and started reading everything I could find. And I say it was a moment of serendipity. Well, it was a decade of serendipity because I was so engaged with the project. So I wrote one book, and then my people who went into the jungle, they were all from Hoboken, New Jersey. So they come back from the jungle. And so it's not only about jungle with the three books together, it's the jungle, it's Hoboken and Manhattan, across the river and back and forth. So it's two groups of people on two different continents and their movement back and forth.
Okay.
And that's a very long answer to your question.
Oh, I didn't think it was a long answer at all.
Oh, good. Okay.
No. I think that's really interesting. So is it, because as I was going through your site, some of your books have magical realism. Are these more historical fiction, would you say? Or do these have some magical realism? What is is there a genre that these belong to?
I guess it's historical fiction. I don't think there are some magical moments, and they mostly happen in the jungle and having to do with the indigenous people there. Mm-hmm. So, but it's not magical. It's not a lot of magical realism. There's also a lot of historical stuff. The book, the second book in particular, takes place mostly back in Hoboken. And World War I had a huge impact on Hoboken, which I didn't know when I chose Hope. Another moment of serendipity.
Yeah.
I chose Hoboken because I was there visiting somebody and I needed a place for my characters to be from.
Sure.
And I thought, this is a great place, and it's near where I grew up. So I chose it. But when I started researching, I found out that Hoboken played a huge part in World War I. The doughboys left from the docks in Hoboken to go to Europe. So the shipyards in Hoboken were owned mostly by Germans.
Yeah.
And when we got involved in the war, the Germans got kicked out of their own shipyards.
Yeah.
And they were exiled, and we took them over. And we used them for people to go back and forth to Europe. And so there was a huge impact. German businesses closed down.
Yeah.
Germans weren't trusted. Everybody was afraid that they were going to these are German Americans we're talking about. But at that time, people were afraid that they would, sabotage ships. They told everybody who lived within a half a mile of the Hoboken Harbor that they had to move if they had any German ancestry. Get out of their homes. So everything, one thing led to another, and I wound up with three books worth of story.
Wow. That's really exciting. How's the, what's it been like to launch during COVID? Or did you flight these out, or did you drop them all together?
Oh, no. The first one came out, they came out a year apart. So the last one, River Aria, came out during COVID.
Okay.
Yeah. So I didn't do any readings or anything like that.
But you've got readers invested in the story and I'm sure excited for the end of the trilogy. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
You know, people who read the first two mostly bought the third one as well. So
I really enjoy novels that can give you a slice of, I mean, we read, one of the reasons we read novels is just to be transported into a world we don't know. And that doesn't have to be fantasy, right? It doesn't have to be dragons and witches for it to be a world we don't know. It can be an industry, a time, a place. And so I love this idea that you're going from the familiar of Hoboken, New Jersey into the jungle, but in an industry we don't, you know, most of us don't know anything about, in a time we didn't live through. So that is, I don't know. I am intrigued.
Well, I knew nothing about the rubber boom. I thought that rubber got made in factories. I had no clue. And when I stumbled on it because of reading this book for for the freelance job that I had, I didn't only learn how rubber is extracted from trees. I learned about Manaus, Brazil. Manaus is kind of the river, the Amazon River is flowing, you know, from the ocean, from the Atlantic to into the heartland, into the middle of the Amazon rainforest. And Manaus is the furthest place that you can get where the water is still deep enough that big ships can be there.
Okay.
So Manaus necessarily became the headquarters for the rubber boom.
Yeah.
And so it was a sleepy fishing village before then. There was nothing there.
Right.
And so that became part of my research. And the second trip, when I finished the first draft of the first book, I went to Manaus to see the architecture there. Because what happened was all these wealthy European people came in with the idea of becoming rubber barons once we started, you know, there was not a great need for rubber historically until cars. And as soon as cars were invented, now we needed tires. So everybody was hot to get rubber. So savvy Europeans and some Americans realized that going into Manaus and setting up a hub where you could bring in rubber, have people go into the jungle and bring the rubber, would make you a lot of money. So they did that, but they weren't content to live in the infrastructure that was there.
Right.
So they built amazing buildings. They were making so much money so fast. They built a very famous opera house, which becomes central to my third book. And they tried to bring in performers and they were all getting malaria.
Oh, no.
So Manaus has its own extremely rich history, all having to do with the rubber boom. And then what happened was there was a guy who stole thousands of rubber seeds, an English guy, right before the rubber boom started. And then he took the rubber seeds back to England and they were planted in English territories in India. And they began to produce. So the rubber boom only lasted a short time. And as soon as the rubber plantations in India began to produce, the entrepreneurs just left. They got up and they left very quickly, and which left all the people in Manaus who were poor to begin with, without jobs. You know, all of a sudden, all the people that had changed their lives were gone.
Right.
So it was a really, really rich history, and
so a real like a boom and bust.
Right.
Situation.
And the problem was that you couldn't go into the jungle and make a plantation. Henry Ford tried to do it, but there was a blight with the trees in the South American jungle, so that one tree would catch it from the next if you put them close together. The only way to extract rubber was to go into the jungle and find trees far apart. They were growing far apart, which was really dangerous because you encountered everything, snakes, spiders, starvation, malaria.
Wow.
Full Monty.
Wow. It's such a rich industrial history. I just knew that, like, I have a vague idea that, like, of when people learned how to vulcanize rubber, I know that was important And then petroleum, I believe, gave us synthetic rubber for tires. Mm-hmm. And that like as a whole, rubber as a natural product, as like a plant-based product, kind of came to an end. That's my trivial pursuit understanding of the rubber industry.
Well, you know more than I knew before I started.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting. Charles Goodyear had a moment of serendipity because he was rubber in its natural state, natural rubber in its natural state, changes with the weather. You know, it kind mm-hmm. of melts when it's hot and it stiffens up when it gets cold. And he knew that it was going to be a really important substance, but he couldn't figure out how to make it so that it was weatherproof. Mm. And he accidentally dropped a blob of rubber, the story goes, on the stove, and it immediately was weatherproof. And so that's how that came about. So that was his moment of serendipity.
Wow. So you've tipped your cards already that your favorite thing is serendipity. For you, was serendipity that something like as an adult you came to understand it as a concept, and then you looked back and you were able to see moments that had been serendipitous? Or was it something you were introduced to young and you more actively seek out? Like, what's your relationship to the idea of serendipity?
Well, I think everybody enjoys coincidence, you mm-hmm. know, and to me, serendipity is a more intense occasion of coincidence. Mm-hmm. So, but coincidence is kind of neutral. If you see your neighbor outside cutting his lawn and you wonder, you know, what his what kind of life he has besides when you see him cutting his lawn, and then you happen to go to a thriller movie theater someplace and you see him in there, you say, oh, I was just wondering what he likes to do for recreation. Mm-hmm. So you say to yourself, that's a coincidence, but it's yeah. a neutral experience. You don't experience it as something good or bad. It's just you saw him there. So serendipity takes it a step further, and it's good. It's like happy accidents,
which yeah.
I think is, you know, it's like getting a gift. We all like gifts. So mm-hmm. I like that. I like it in my life. And I like, I feel like you can't really control how often you have moments of serendipity, mm-hmm. but you can say yes to different occasions that might spark it. Like mm-hmm. Just being out in the world, which is hard for me because I hate leaving my comfort zone, even mm-hmm. though good things happen when I do.
Yeah.
I sit in front of my desk all day long.
Yeah. I agree. It's very, and especially in this last year and a half, it's become a very safe place to be at home with your computer, with your own things. Do you have a first defining moment when you think about serendipity in your life? I mean, obviously getting assigned a book as a freelancer to review and help blurb that then leads to a 10-year to trips and writing a trilogy and deep investigation into the rubber industry is a small drop with a big impact. Do you have any earlier defining serendipity moments that always kind of stand out to you?
I do. You know, you're saying, you asked me if you realize when you're having the moment of serendipity, you know, if you recognize it or if you need to look back. And mm-hmm. I think it's kind of a combination. You have a sense that this is going to be really good. I've gotten on a path that's going to be really intense for me. Mm-hmm. But you, until you walk on that path for a while, you can't really be sure. But so I went through a very depressing divorce some mm-hmm. years ago, and I was really keeping to myself. I had I had an older son and I had a young son, and I was just keeping to myself, and a friend of mine invited me to come over. She was having some people over, and I said, I really don't want to. I'm just feeling like I want to stay home. And yeah. She kind of said, oh, come on, just come over for a little while. You don't yeah. have to stay long. So I went over and I walked into a room and I met two people. They were, astrologically speaking, it seems like this is incredible to me. Yeah. Two people sitting in the same place. They were looking at my friend's son's rock collection. They didn't know each other. They were just mm-hmm. looking at, the kid brought the rock collection over and they both started looking at it with him. And at the same time, and I met them, and they were both the people who were about to change my life in incredible ways. Hmm. My friend Julie, it turned out to be a writer also. Mm-hmm. And she read my books, you know, to date. I read her books, and I thought, I read her manuscripts. She was a wonderful writer, and she had an agent, and her book hadn't been published, and my books had. And I thought, how can it be that her book wasn't published and mine have? And I got this idea in my head, because I had done so much work for publishers that mm-hmm. I had some idea how the business went. And I went to her and I said, you know what, I'm going to start a small publishing company and I'm going to publish your book. Mm. And so, and then about 3 days later, I thought, what have I done? I don't have the knowledge.
Right.
I just, you know, don't have the money. I don't have this. I don't have that, but I said it. And so I felt committed to do it. And I pushed myself to do it. And it pushed me so far out of my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be an incredible experience. Also, Julie's the reason I'm here. I came to visit her here and fell in love with New Mexico. Otherwise, I would never be here. And the other person I married. Oh. So the two people who were, you know, who would change my life for the, you know, possibly the rest of my life,
right.
Hopefully the rest of my life, I met in the same second. So I think that's a moment of serendipity.
Right. As they were just looking at rocks, looking at a kid's rock collection.
Yeah. The kid was like 8 years old and just brought, look at my rocks. And so they weren't even talking to each other, but then they kind of, you know, bent in together mm-hmm. and started looking at his collection. And that's when I walked in and somebody introduced me. So.
Wow. That's, I love that. I love that you were willing to say yes to go to the parting, because it can be so, it's just so easy to stay home. And that your friend, your neighbor made, like, really got you out and got you moving.
Yeah. Well, that's the hard part, because usually I will say no, mm-hmm. you know, when I'm asked to do something. But I find that all of my moments of serendipity have been when I said yes, even though I didn't want to. Oh, I see that pretty cat.
Yeah. This is Spidey. He's from Durango. Spidey.
Aww.
He's 20.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah. He was born on the patio of a restaurant where I was a waitress in Durango. He's a spoiled old man. I love him a lot. Yeah.
Aww. He's beautiful.
Yeah.
He looks really healthy.
He's doing pretty good. So, okay. So you said yes, you go to the party. You meet one of your closest friends who becomes your first reader. So when you did that publishing house, was her book the only book you published? Or once you got it up set up and you learned all the processes, did you continue to publish works?
No, I published for 5 years.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you another story of serendipity that has to do with the end of my publishing career. I was freelancing the whole time I was publishing. Mm-hmm. I was basically freelancing to pay for my publishing habit, because mm-hmm. nowadays if you want to publish a book, you can publish it books on demand.
Yeah.
So it's only printed if somebody buys it and they're going to read it. Back then, before 2005, I published from like 1999 to 2005. You had to go to a printer and you had to pay a lot of money
right.
to print a book. And nobody printed paperbacks back then. You had to publish hardcover. There mm-hmm. was no such thing as an ebook.
Right.
So, but if you wanted reviews, you had to do hardcover. So it was a very expensive proposition. what I found was I was really good as a publisher. I published everybody I published. I went on to publish, I don't know, 12 books or something over a period of 5 years. And it was a great experience for me. My confidence level before I started publishing was kind of flat. So I found skills that I didn't know I had.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, having to reach out to people constantly and call them up and ask them to give me prices and, you know, work with me on this and that and cover artists. And I just, every writer that I published, I had a relationship with. It just worked out that way. In fact, a woman came to visit me last weekend who is from Durango, and I published her book. Her name is Kate Niles, and she had a book called The Basket Maker that I published, and it won the Forward Magazine Book of the Year for fiction. They give out two major prizes. One is for fiction and non. And that was a cash prize and a trophy. So it was a really big deal. So I had all these great moments through publishing, and I probably would have gone on to do it forever. But in those days, publishers had distributors. Nowadays, you just have to find your own crazy ways to drive people to, you know, your website to buy your book. But back then, you had distributors, and the distributors would go to Barnes & Noble and Borders and all the big stores, some of which no longer exist, and they would sell the books in. And my distributor went out of business owing me for two books. So I had the books printed. He sold the books in to Barnes & Noble and Borders.
And he never paid you back for them.
Not only me, but there were, he had like 80 client publishers. So, and I was one of the smallest. And all those people lost a whole lot of money. What I lost was nothing compared to what they lost.
Right.
So it was a devastating thing to go through for somebody, you know, who was, you know, kind of paying as she went. And I had borrowed a lot of money from a bank for the two books that he went out of business with. But when I found out about it, I happened to be in Florida visiting a friend from when I lived there. And I was trying to contact my publisher, my distributor, through email, and I couldn't get a hold of them. So I tried calling, and I got, you know, messages that said, you know, their phone is not in order anymore. And so I called other people who distributed through them, and they told me the bad news that they'd gone bankrupt like overnight with everybody's books and everybody's money. So my friend had a friend who had just come back from climbing Mount Everest, and he had a Sherpa prayer shawl that that he was given when he reached the top, the summit. And he, my friend Susan, was going through a hard time with a couple of things happening in her life. And so he came back with this shawl, and he said, I want you to have this because these things are made with good intentions, and they're made, you know, to spread prayers and spread love. And so Susan accepted it, and her problem was resolved. And then I'm sitting at her house just learning that my distributor went out of business owing me money that I was going to have to pay back from who knows where.
Right.
And crying, you know, what am I going to do? And she came out, she gave me the prayer shawl, and I brought it home with me. And all the time that I was, you know, going through calling lawyers to see if I could sue the company and, you know, trying to figure out what to do, could I find another distributor, which I did. but all the time I was going through the devastation from what had happened, I was wearing the prayer shawl. And it's not that I really believed that it was magical, although I didn't not believe it, but I didn't. It was, I think it was like a symbol of believing that good outcomes are possible more than anything. And I just thought that was, you know, wonderful that I happened to be there. And she gave me that thing that made me feel like I had, you know, a superpower that I could get through this. And then it passed. I did find another distributor, although I never got back on my feet again totally with publishing. And I, you know, stopped another book or two later. But when I did get back on my feet and I felt better about everything and I started paying off the debt that I had, I passed the prayer shawl on to a friend of mine. Yeah. So I just thought that was a really wonderful thing to happen. You know,
that's really beautiful. Yeah, I love that having a personal totem that you can share with friends. It's, I don't know. There's like a, I feel like there's an urban legend among, you know, like I'm a middle-aged Jewish woman. A lot of my friends have done fertility treatments of different sorts. And there's this like urban legend of fertility treatments of like the somebody getting sperm from a sperm bank, and then they got pregnant naturally. So they passed it along to the next person, and it was like just having it in your freezer was what you needed. Like nobody ever used the sperm, but somehow it was like passing this item from one person to the next. It kind of was imbued. To my knowledge, that wasn't actually in any of my friend groups, but it's one of those stories that always feels like one person away.
I never heard that. I love it. Yeah. I love it. But it's the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. It's acting as a possibility, you know, sitting there in the freezer. It's the belief in possibility.
Right.
So,
well, it's what you heard in that interview of changing the dream.
Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever come back to you and said, Joan, I don't know if you remember this, but this moment you and I had created a change for me?
Well, I don't know if anybody ever came back to me. I mean, people have, you know, I've been the recipient of some goodwill because mm-hmm. of things that have happened, but I don't know if it's ever been anything that you could encapsulate into one moment of serendipity. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really coming up with anything off the top of my head.
It's a really hard question. I'm trying to think through, like, has anyone ever told me? Because sometimes you'll have, this moment, you know, that someone else will hold on to for a long time and other people won't remember at all. Like, we definitely all have those of the moments that, you know, when I, in the summer of 96, I lived in San Francisco, and the first week I was there, I stayed in a hostel, and then I sublet an apartment in the Mission District. And one of those nights, one of the guys from the hostel and I just kind of ran around San Francisco. I was 19. I didn't have a fake ID. I wasn't going in anywhere. And we wound up, like, we went to Coit Tower. And then we were, like, sitting at the base of the Transamerica building, which is that really distinct pyramid in San Francisco. And someone came out of they were cleaning up, like, the five-star restaurant, like, the very fancy businessman's restaurant. And they came out and they just threw probably like 50 white tulips on the ground. Like, they were just like trashing their floral arrangements. And that to me is like such a clear memory. I don't remember his name. I don't remember the name of the restaurant, but it has always been like, it's one of like the clear moments of that summer is what it was like to turn this corner and see a bench and see like 50 tulips, white tulips, beautiful, that had just been like chucked out of a restaurant. Strange.
Wow. It's beautiful. It reminds me of that movie. I think Kevin Spacey was in it. American Rose or something. Mm-hmm. Like that? American Beauty. Yeah.
Where there were those scenes with like those, of like the rose petals falling. There was so much of that. And then the imagery of the plastic bag.
Yes. And it was beautiful. The mm-hmm. young kid across the street was a photographer, and he just filmed this plastic bag blowing in the wind, and mm-hmm. and with the right music behind it, it was really gorgeous.
Yeah.
And that's all I remember about that movie. I mean, I remember there were scary parts, and I don't want, you know, but mostly I remember the rose petals and the plastic bag.
Yeah.
That's the images. Same.
That's also the same, the plastic bag kind of dancing. And I think because if you know, I live in a city with a lot of those little vortexes, and anytime I see a plastic bag, it calls back to that scene.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. really great scene.
Yeah. These little moments that are not the point of the movie or the book that stick with you. Another one for me is, I think it's in the novel The Shining, because I don't think I ever watched the movie. Too scary. But in the novel The Shining, before the, so there's the kid and a caretaker who both have kind of clairvoyant abilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how they smell an orange before they get information. Like they smell an orange being peeled. And I don't think it's a detail that stands out to many people, but for some reason, that's my takeaway of The Shining, is that if you smell like ghost orange peel, just orange peel out of nowhere, that that is the precursor to a clairvoyant event.
Wow.
But that's all I remember of that book.
I don't remember that.
Right.
All I remember is that I was so scared when I read that book. That when I read The Stand, Stephen King's The Stand, I had to keep the book in another room when I went to bed. I couldn't be in the same room with it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So scary.
I don't seek out horror or scary movies anymore. The last time I did was Stranger Things on Netflix. And I've told this story before. That to me, because it takes place in Indiana in the 1980s, and it hits on everything, every single thing in that book that's scary is what was scary about growing up in Indiana in the 80s, which is where I grew up. It's like swimming in strip pits, because kids, like people drown in strip pits all the time because you get caught on left behind mining equipment, or like strip pits were really dangerous for swimming. So there's a strip pit swimming scene. There's, you know, we would just ride our bikes forever with no contact. There's railroad stuff. There's Dungeons and Dragons spookiness. And it just, I got to the point with that book where I would have to, I would go and I would spoil the episode for myself, make sure I knew what was coming, and then I could watch it and I would still be scared.
Oh, wow.
So
It wasn't a book, though. It was just a series, right?
It was just a series.
Yeah. I watched that, too. I loved that, actually. Yeah. I loved all the kids in it.
Mm-hmm. Such a good cast.
Finn Wolf.
Finn, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, Finn. Yeah. And what he was in Goldfinch. And he played a kid, a Russian kid with an accent.
Mm-hmm.
He was really wonderful. And I don't remember the girl's name, but she's wonderful.
Yeah.
She's all grown up now.
Such an outstanding cast.
And he was in a band.
There's Millie Bobby Brown is Millie. 11. Yeah. There's Finn Wolfhard. Gatton Matarazzo. Maybe... There's Caleb McLaughlin, Charlie Heaton, Joe Keery. But such a man, what an outstanding cast. And it's hard to cast kids because you don't know how they're going to grow, and you don't know how they're going to grow into a character when you have a story that's planned for longer than one movie or one season.
Also, they were supposed to begin filming a season here in Albuquerque because we have incredible film studios here, and they didn't because of COVID. So I don't know if they're doing that now, but they have to all be, you know, like in their early 20s at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So really different, but.
Yeah. Were there any TV shows or movies that stand out to you for COVID? Did you spend any time just like watching TVs and movies, or were you a reader during it?
Well, I'm always a reader, but I also like to watch movies too. Mm-hmm. So I saw the Queen's Gambit.
Yes.
I love that.
Oh my gosh. It was so good.
everybody loved that. You know, who would have thought that a movie that's just about chess, I mean, mm-hmm. mostly what happens is you see her, you know, playing chess with different people would become so popular. But everybody I know loves that. And a lot of people I know who never had a chess board in their lives went out and bought them.
Nice.
So
I loved the way that they represented thinking through playing chess, how they would show her like visualizing, and the way that they brought that to life was, I just thought, so well done.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really wonderful. And chess can be very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So do you play chess?
You know, I used to play chess. I haven't played in a long time because I haven't had anybody, you know, close by in my life. My sons, mm-hmm. Were both became good players. And then, what happened with, so I had this one experience with chess that was incredible to me, although it doesn't come over well as a story, but my ex-husband was supposed to play chess with this guy that we would see every year when we went to Maine for mm-hmm. like a week, and they would sit and play chess the whole week long. And the guy's wife and I never, you know, we knew how to play chess, but nobody ever invited us to play. And
yeah,
one board, so they played. And my ex-husband had sunburn or something one night, and he couldn't play chess. So he asked me to go down to the porch of the B&B we were staying in and tell the guy. And the guy had the board all set up, and I wasn't really close to the guy. But anyway, the guy said, "Well, would you want to play with me since he can't?" And I said, "Okay." Mm-hmm. And I sat down, and I never thought I could beat him. He was a really good player. And I could see victory ahead of me, but I kept thinking, it can't possibly be. I can't mm-hmm. be beating him. My heart was going so fast. I mean, you know, I'm sure people feel like this when they, you know, jump out of airplanes or something.
Right.
I felt like it in front of the chessboard because I saw it coming, and it didn't seem possible. And then it happened, and I beat him.
Wow.
So, yeah. Then I quit.
Yeah. One and oh. Time to.
Yeah. That was it.
Yeah.
It took
a perfect record. A perfect record.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I loved about Queen's Gambit, I mean, the costuming was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But I was constantly on edge waiting. No man in the show ever hurts her. Like, ever takes a hand against her. There's no sexual assault. There's no violence. I mean, her adopted father abandoning the family, that is violence. I don't want to say that's not, but they kept setting up these like dark corners or these moments where I feel like almost any other movie would have turned her into a victim. And I really right. appreciated that through the whole show, she does not become the victim of violence in that way.
Right. That's how I felt. Did you ever see the movie Patterson with Adam Driver?
No.
Oh my God.
He's an amazing actor.
This is a wonderful movie where nothing happens. Mm-hmm. Almost nothing happens, but you can't believe that nothing's happening. So when he's driving the bus and, you know, he's looking around or talking to somebody, you think, okay, this is it. He's going to have a bus. He's a bus driver, I should say. You think he's going to have an accident. And this is going to be the inflection point in the movie. And that's not it. You know, it's never it. And then when the real thing happens in the movie, that kind of throws his life into chaos. It's a small thing that you would, I won't tell you because I don't want to spoil it, but it's a wonderful movie, just beautiful. And there's a relationship in there. He has a girlfriend, and sometimes you see actors and you don't really get the chemistry between mm-hmm. them. It seems so, so pushed, you know, it doesn't seem real, but his relationship with this girl, it was just, the chemistry is incredible and beautiful movie to watch.
And it's Patterson with Adam Driver.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
It takes place in Patterson, New Jersey.
Okay. That sounds like a good Saturday night movie night.
Yeah.
I watched a lot of TV at the very beginning. And a lot of like repeat, you know, things I'd seen before. And then have been re-engaging with audiobooks the last couple months, which has been nice.
Yeah.
Because I found that COVID really knocked my ability to like sit and read sideways. It just has been hard to find that attention span.
Yeah, you know, I heard a lot of people say that mm-hmm. during COVID, that they couldn't really read until we started coming out of it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. But I'm starting to feel it coming back, and I'm looking forward to, like, last winter I told my family, no books for the holidays. I'm just going to feel guilty because I'm not going to be able to read them. So this is a book-free, you know, Christmas and Hanukkah season. And then this year I think I can say, all right, books are allowed again.
I read about a wonderful thing that they do in, I don't know, Denmark and in different Scandinavian countries where people arrange to be in a certain place at a certain time, and everybody's a book. You just, mm-hmm. you are a book. It's kind of like what you do with your show. And yeah. You walk up to somebody, you sit down next to them, and they start telling you their story. And the idea is to, you know, talk to different people, and everybody shares their story.
Yeah.
So you just go there willing to be a book.
You would have to look that there. Up. Yeah.
I'll find the link for you and I'll email it to you.
Please do. And I'll share the link in the show notes.
Okay.
Yeah. That's good. Joan, is there anything about serendipity that you had planned on sharing that I didn't ask the right question for?
Well, I went through, I looked up to find out where the word serendipity mm-hmm. comes from. And there's actually a fairy tale. It's a Persian fairy tale that started in 1300, but it's been told and translated in many countries and many languages. And it's about a king, the king of Serendip, which is apparently what Sri Lanka was called at one point.
Okay.
And he's got three sons, and they're all princes. And he gives them the best education you could get at that time. Mm-hmm. They know everything about the arts and the sciences. But he still feels that they're not equipped to take over the throne when mm-hmm. he passes. So he sends them out into the world and says, you know, go out and see things. And while they're gone, they have all these adventures, and good things happen and bad things happen. And apparently, if you read the whole thing, you know, it's just quite long. And when they come back, what they tell him about is all of these incredible experiences, all the good things. They don't tell him about the bad things, you know, mm-hmm. where they've been in trouble. But they make the point that actually they decide to coin a word. They say that unexpectedly, one can find what's pleasant and new, though it was never sought. And they decide that that's what they learned
on their travels, their
adventures. And so they coined the word serendipity, which I think is really great.
It's beautiful. I've never heard that before.
And then I have a quote from Milan Kundera, the mm-hmm. Czechoslovakian writer, who happens to be one of my favorites, and I'll just read that to you real quick. He says, "Chance and chance alone has a message for us. Everything that occurs out of necessity, everything unexpected, repeated day in and day out, is mute. Only chance can speak to us." And I love that.
That is a powerful quote. And I think it's, I really appreciated your framing at the beginning where you talked about, you know, coincidence as neutral and serendipity as being something that is positive, that uplifts, that gives you a learning opportunity. I really like that framing that you shared, and these quotes really, or the story of where serendipity came from and this quote are an outstanding bookend to that.
Yes, yes.
Well, Joan, do you want people to be able to find you on the internet?
Yeah, my big long last name. You'd have to know how to spell it, but I have a website, and all of my books are listed there, and some stuff about me, and so that's fine. I love to hear from people. There's a contact thing there.
Great. The entire River trilogy is available. Before We Died, Gifts for the Dead, and River Aria. They are available in paperback and digital.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you can find Joan on Twitter. She's Joan Schwei, Joan Schweigart on Instagram, and Joan Schweigart Writer on Facebook. All of this will be included in the show notes because it is a somewhat tricky last name to spell.
Yes.
And as well as all of your other books. I mean, it's quite a career you have.
Oh, thank you.
It's
been fun. It's what I like to do. So
good.
I mean, if you ask me what's my favorite thing, it's writing. Mm-hmm. So, but you know.
Well, I've enjoyed talking about serendipity and learning how a serendipitous moment led you on this trilogy.
Well, it's been great talking to you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.